leader with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, this past weekend in Portland, a number of anti-war organizations voiced their opinions on military recruiting in high schools. Rural communities across the region are reeling from a proposal in the Bush administration's new budget plan, and the hunter shot by Vice President Cheney is recovering in a hospital.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,267 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,013 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention. And in 2004, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 13th, 2006. I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Andy Seaton. Military recruiting at high schools is a hot-button topic across the nation. This past weekend in Portland, a number of anti-war organizations voiced their opinions on the subject at a protest in front of the local military recruiting center on Northeast Broadway. I filed this report earlier today. Several organizations picketed the Military Recruiting Center in Northeast Portland over the weekend. The No War Drum Corps, Code Pink, War Resisters League, and others were out in force making noise and handing out literature. They were protesting the military's deceptive recruiting practices.
They're making false promises. They're taking advantage of kids who, you know, come from low-income families or don't have a lot of options after high school, and they're encouraging them to sign up for the military and making all kinds of promises when they know damn well that, you know, they're probably just going to wind up in Iraq.
The War Resisters League also goes into schools to get their message directly to students being targeted by the military.
It's really up to the teachers if they're willing to have us in. You know, we don't really ask the principals because they're too concerned about public opinion and everything, but if an individual teacher can say it's part of their curriculum and so forth, then we can get in and do that. The War Resisters League also sponsors a project where we stand out in front of the high schools and pass out these little bookmark-shaped flyers, you know, just to give students some contact information and a little blurb on, you know, what's wrong with the military recruiting program, that kind of thing. We also sometimes put ads in student newspapers, too. We try to, you know, do a smattering of things to try to get the word out. You know, we're not here to tell students what to do, but we want them to know what their options are and want to encourage them to think critically about these issues.
The protesters were also getting out the word on the upcoming third anniversary of the war in Iraq.
We're trying to start the publicity for the March 19th massive peace rally and march to bring the troops home now and end the occupation of Iraq and the Palestinian territories and, you know, other issues that are definitely very related to that, such as the human rights issues and civil liberty issues as well.
The March 19th march will start in Waterfront Park at 1:30 p.m. The recruiting station is also picketed every second Saturday of the month from 11 till 1. I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
Almost $500,000 was seized yesterday afternoon in a routine traffic stop on I-5 north of Salem, an Oregon record. Investigators say they believe the cash is linked to drug trafficking, but no one was arrested. The cash was hidden in a false compartment of an SUV, but there apparently were no drugs. Federal drug officials say Interstate 5 is one of the top five major drug corridors in the nation. The driver was a 22-year-old woman from Seattle, the patrol said. Also yesterday, a driving complaint of a speeding car northbound on Interstate 5 near Albany led to the seizure of more than 2 pounds of marijuana. Two Washington residents were arrested.
The Oregon Department of Transportation has approved an agreement to let an Australian bank study whether it could make money building a proposed Sunrise Corridor as a toll road. The highway through Eastland communities to Highway 26 on the way to Mount Hood has been in the work for decades. Clackamas County officials promise promise public input will be gathered before any decision is made. It would build a toll road to Damascus. They say there's no other funding available for the Sunrise Corridor on the horizon. The Oregon Department of Transportation reached a pre-development agreement with the company Macquarie Bank to study three possible toll projects in Oregon. They include Sunrise Corridor, the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass, and a proposal to widen I-205.
Rural communities across the region are reeling from a proposal in the Bush administration's new budget plan. The proposal phases out a program that has pumped more than $2 billion into rural states hurt by the logging cutbacks on federal land. Past budgets have sent money earned from logging federal land to rural community schools. Earlier this week, KBOO's Stephanie Potter talked with Stephen Padiri, program manager for Oregon Natural Resources, about the effect Bush's budget would have on rural communities in Oregon.
This is something, for years and years, one of the ways the Forest Service and the logging industry promoted more logging on public lands in Oregon, and this is, to be clear, only from federal public lands, not from private timberlands, not from state timberlands, only from our national forests and Bureau of Land Management lands. Some of the proceeds from logging those areas would go to the counties, and the counties would use it to fund schools.
And libraries and other things I've been reading, too?
Yes. The lion's share went to schools, but other local infrastructure, too.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple problems with that. One, it wasn't really a predictable level of funding, because if you had a boom year and prices for timber were really high, you'd get a lot of money. If you had a bust year and prices are really low and not a lot of logging was going on, you wouldn't get much money. And then it all got wrapped around the axles of the big fights in the early 90s to end logging and old growth stands in Oregon and throughout the Northwest, and in logging in areas that had not yet been developed in sort of the roadless backcountry areas. And, you know, folks on the other side of the logging issue from us wanted to see these rural schools funded through logging old growth, and we wanted to see these rural schools funded in a different way. We worked with Senator Wyden and a number of other members of Congress to establish this county payments program, and what it did was establish this predictable level of funding in place of tying the funding to logging. And it sort of decoupled the two and had a lot of positive benefits aside from giving the counties a predictable level of funding. It also really brought people together in terms of conservationists, hunters, rural governments, to get on the same page on land management. We weren't fighting over logging anymore. We were working out what kind of projects we could support. And it sort of took that divisive fight over funding for schools out of the picture. What the Bush administration is trying to do with this budget is really destroy all that goodwill that's happened in the last 5 years and take us back to the bad old days.
Right.
They're offering less money than the schools currently get and the counties currently get, and they're tying any future money to selling off public lands. I mean, if one were cynical, one would say what the Bush administration is doing is by tying funding to selling off public lands, and you know, not just logging them, but selling them, getting them out of the ownership of the taxpayers.
I read that. How much does he want to sell now?
It's roughly $800 million worth of land. It's a lot of land.
Yeah, and somebody said that was about 170,000 acres. I read that somewhere.
That's an estimate. So far, there hasn't been a map or specific proposals put out by the administration, and you know that's just a rough estimate given the current value of timberland, and that's going to vary from place to place. If it's a you know an old growth stand in the Willamette Valley, it's going to be worth a lot more.
Okay, so he wants to sell off $800 million worth of our forest land
in order to provide half of the funding that the schools and rural communities are currently getting from county payments. They would still get a cut in the amount of money they're receiving, but a large chunk of what money they would receive would be tied to selling off these land. The proposal is to do that over 5 years, and that's a good question because they don't have a plan after 5 years. And, you know, as you can imagine, this has sent a lot of folks in the conservation community and, you know, frankly also in rural communities through the roof, because if you're, you know, a rural educator or a county government, you're going to get less money than you were currently receiving. And if you're a conservationist, you're going to have to accept getting rid of a bunch of land that belongs to the American people. And you know, I just don't think that's a recipe for doing anything but creating a lot more conflict. I think the real question is how are folks like Senator Gordon Smith going to react to this? You know, Senator Wyden obviously is going to be very fired up about it. The county payments legislation was his idea. And, you know, he established this program that sort of mended fences and brought peace over funding these rural communities. Senator Smith has been sort of on the fence about this, and, you know, a real question is going to be how are these Republican senators in the West going to react to this idea that these rural communities are going to get less money and it's going to be tied to selling off public lands. And, you know, it's what I fear is it's just going to turn into a big nasty fight, and it's going to destroy a lot of that goodwill and cooperation that's happened in the last 5 years.
That was KBOO's Stephanie Potter speaking with Steve Padiri, Program Manager for Oregon National Resources.
Stay tuned for FSRN after the local news, followed by independent native news. Then at 6 p.m. hear Labor Radio. At 7 is Time Sound with Kevin Berry. Tonight's weather in Portland will be partly cloudy in the evening, then mostly cloudy. Lows in the lower to mid-30s. In Corvallis, it'll be mostly cloudy with fog, lows near 30 degrees. Hood River can expect mostly cloudy weather with isolated rain showers in the evening, lows around 32. Tomorrow, Portland will be mostly cloudy with a chance of showers. Snow levels will fall to 1,000 feet with highs around 45 degrees. Corvallis will be rainy with a high of 43. Hood River can expect mixed rain and snow with highs near 45 degrees. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Paying the Oregon Gardens bills has wiped out Marion County's economic development budget. The county has diverted nearly $1 million a year in state lottery proceeds from creating and retaining jobs to paying for the debt and upkeep of the tourist attraction. 4 years ago, the county issued $5 million in revenue bonds to support the garden. The county obligated itself to hand over lottery funds to make bond payments when the garden failed to make them. The 80-acre garden near Silverton drew 250,000 visitors in its first year, 2001. But attendance fell dramatically. Near the end of last summer, the garden had drawn only 40,000 people. The garden was placed in the hands of a court-appointed receiver when its financial troubles threatened to close for good.
The Coos Bay Daily World reported this weekend on federal campaign to establish new fishing quotas on Pacific Coast whiting, one of the most plentiful fish in the ocean. Lobbyists spoke to the Westport City Council Friday afternoon on behalf of federal legislation to control the so-called race to fish for whiting. Whiting, also called hake, is the largest single biomass of fish in the Pacific Ocean. Processors want the quota because the whiting fishery is so enormous that the current race to fish system limits their ability to process the fish into more lucrative products like fillets and whole fish. Many fishermen, on the other hand, testified that giving part of the quotas to the processors will put too much power in the processors' hands. Fishermen also fear that the whiting quota will lead to quotas in other species, and that the real issue isn't the race to fish, it's the processors who want to control the future of the Pacific Coast fishing in general.
Bah! Sheep ranchers say the Benton County coyote population is way up, and ranchers want to stop that trend. KBOO's Kirk Vanderveer reports.
Local rancher Dennis Gray, who farms near Adair Village, said in the past 3 weeks he's shot a dozen coyotes. Rancher David Horning, who has about 800 ewes near Bell Fountain, said he expects to lose about 100 lambs per season to coyotes, or nearly $15,000 worth. In 2004, Oregon producers lost more than 5,700 sheep and lambs at a value of about $500,000, said Richard Kosasan, executive vice president of the Oregon Sheep Growers Association. And those numbers might be underreported, he said. Besides the loss of the animals, farmers also face costs in trying to prevent kills, including fencing or dogs. Neither of these may adequately deter coyotes, who'll dig under electric fence to guard animals. The State Department of Fish and Wildlife doesn't officially track coyote populations, since a license isn't needed to hunt them. However, ODFW District Wildlife Biologist Nancy Taylor said local farmers have reported a population increase of the small canines. Content was provided by the Corvallis Gazette-Times. I'm Kirk Vanderveer, KBOO News.
And now to follow up on a recent story, the Oregon National Guard member recruited to be a character in the U.S. Army's official video game. Matthew Zedwick of the 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry of the Oregon National Guard, will soon be appearing on toy store shelves in a full-blown action figure, priced at $9.99. In 2004, Zedwick's best friend, both were from Corvallis, was killed right next to him after an improvised explosive device exploded under their Humvee in Iraq. Zedwick saved his platoon leader and key equipment from the burning wreckage. Later this year, Zedwick's character was set to appear on the video game America's Army Real Heroes. Despite the global recognition he will receive from the game and toy marketing, Zedwick will not receive any royalties, only the regular duty pay he received during the modeling sessions. And he has 2 years left in his National Guard enlistment.
A new study says tiny sea creatures known as zooplankton may be the key to fattening up juvenile salmon enough to survive in the ocean. A species of zooplankton called copepods that thrive in the cold water in the Northeast Pacific Ocean have high levels of lipids, or fats, possibly boosting the food chain and allowing salmon to grow fast enough to survive their first year at sea. The copepods store high amounts of the fats in order to hibernate during the winter, much like bears, according to Oregon State University researchers. The copepods, in turn, are eaten by juvenile anchovies, herring, smelt, and krill, boosting the fat content of those species and making them highly nutritious for young coho and Chinook salmon. For years, scientists and the fishing industry have known that good ocean conditions are critical to salmon survival and are linked with strong upwelling that brings nutrient-rich, deeper waters to the surface. The OSU study sheds new light on what makes those conditions favorable for juvenile salmon.
For Oregon families struggling to pay their heating bills, there's been a little warm to warm their hearts this year with an increase in energy costs. But some of them are getting a Valentine. A little extra help thanks to the one-time emergency energy settlement from the state's low-income energy assistance program. KBOO's Kirk Vandeveer reports.
The thousands of Oregon households who can't pay their increasing energy bills are getting a special Valentine this month. A one-time energy settlement means $5.5 million additional dollars for the state's low-income energy assistance programs. Duke Energy and El Paso Corporations both participated in the California price manipulations. Jim Abramson with the Oregon Energy Partnership says that will be a big help because low-income families are struggling with higher energy costs.
People are coming in with higher bills than they did last year, 20 to 30% higher bills. With the exception of the settlement fund, the funding is pretty much the same this year as it was last year.
Abramson says that with current funding, less than one in five families who qualify for help are getting it.
There's still over 15,000 Oregonians that are on waiting lists, and that figure is actually understated.
Abramson says the most recent look at energy assistance shows 2,000 to 3,000 people call every day asking for help. A majority of them have already had their utility disconnected or received a shutoff notice, and most will get no help, even with the settlement. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Kirk Vandeveer, KBOO News.
A new dam will not rise on the Kalama River, a spokesperson for the State Department of Ecology said this week. That's despite the fact that the Kalama appeared as a possibility for a new storage reservoir in a recent study commissioned by the Department of Ecology and the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. State officials are struggling to divvy up a scarce supply of water in the Columbia River Basin among growing demands for industrial development, fish flows, irrigation, power generation, and recreational needs. They think a new storage reservoir may provide a solution. The Department of Ecology, along with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, commissioned a Seattle-based consulting firm to compile information about potential dam sites within 10 miles of the main stem of the Columbia River. A state spokesperson said Tuesday the dam is likely to be somewhere above the Priest Rapids Dam, which spans the Columbia River north of the Tri-Cities in eastern Washington, where the need for water is the most acute.
Harry Whittington, the hunter shot by Vice President Dick Cheney, is recovering nicely and will be moved out of the trauma intensive care unit later today. But grassroots radio programmers around the nation are calling it the curse of Coop. What has been less widely reported is that Whittington is the landlord of Radio KOOP in Austin, Texas. In two apparently separate unrelated fires have broken out this month in the building, housing Coop. The station, KBOO's counterpart in Austin, remains off the air. Whittington, who is 78, was hit Sunday by a spray of birdshot fired by the vice president while the men were out quail hunting on Saturday in Texas. He's in the Corpus Christi Hospital being treated for multiple pellet wounds. The White House says President Bush found out Saturday evening that Vice President had accidentally shot a hunting companion, but kept the information to himself. The story first appeared nearly 24 hours after the shooting. CNN has also reported that Cheney was hunting illegally. I guess Republicans are out of season.
The current time is 5:22. And now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Gosh, so much muck to rake, so little time. I speak, of course, about George W.'s recent State of the Union pontifications. What a mess of lies. His headline grabber was that America is, quote, addicted to oil, and that he'll cut U.S. reliance on Middle East oil by 75% over the next 20 years. Wow, that's a huge change, right? Wrong. Bush didn't mention that our imports from the Mideast constitute a mere 11% of America's oil use. Also, the next day, his own energy secretary rushed out to say of Bush's 75% pledge, he didn't mean it literally. The promise to cut Mideast imports, quote, was purely an example, he said. Oh. Then there was George's proud economic boast that America has created 4.6 million new jobs during his tenure. Well, yeah, but America has also lost 2.6 million jobs under Bush, leaving a pathetic record of job creation. Plus, Bush's new jobs pay so poorly that hourly workers are not even keeping up with inflation. Of course, a Bush speech would not be complete without another Iraq lie. This time, he gloated about his success in, quote, shutting off terrorist infiltration into Iraq. Well, not exactly. In fact, just before George's speech, a top Republican wailed that the Iraqi border is, quote, extremely porous, and that a poor job was being done to stop infiltration by terrorists. The Bush lies just kept flowing. He bragged about reducing federal spending, for example, when in fact he's raised it about 30%, and he patted himself on the back about his response to Hurricane Katrina. Yet the very next day, the General Accounting Office blasted his administration and Bush himself for their failed response. This is Jim Hightower saying, this guy will go down in history as President Pinocchio. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 13th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please give us a call at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on Translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 on Translator K220HR. You can log into our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vandeveer. Special thanks go to reporter Stephanie Potter, Andy Seaton, and Kirk Vandeveer. Our engineer is John Delderfield. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, and following that, Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow, here are the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, hear Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host Talk Radio. Their guest is former Willamette Week publisher Ron Well. He'll discuss his opposition to the current transit mall plan for downtown Portland. TriMet has also been invited. At 9 on Between the Covers, Ed Goldberg interviews Greg Ruka, author of Private Wars, a spy novel set in Uzbekistan. At 9:30, a group of local film buffs will help you decide which films to see of the more than 75 offerings in the Portland International Film Festival. And at 10:30 on Stage and Studio, DeMay Roberts has a Valentine's Day special. And of course, at 11 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, February 13, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Michael Chertoff responds one day after House Republicans blame him for many of Hurricane Katrina's response failures. Over 100 Hyatt Hotel housekeepers have been protesting daily for over 1 week in San Diego. And we'll hear about the protest plan tonight in New York City to denounce the FBI raids in Puerto Rico. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Ibrahim al-Jafari has been nominated by Iraq's ruling Shia coalition to stay on as prime minister in the newly elected government. His nomination yesterday defeated the other leading candidate by just one vote. Another U.S. rocket landed in Pakistan over the weekend. Masroor Hussein reports from Islamabad.
Two civilian women were killed and five children injured in the troubled North Waziristan region on Saturday when one of the four rockets fired from Afghanistan hit their nomadic shelter 4 kilometers from the border. There are still unconfirmed reports that U.S. planes intruded into Pakistani territory and bombed a village in Suleiman Khel. Witnesses in the area say U.S.-led allied troops fired rockets after Taliban fighters fired 18 mortar shells at one of their posts. In Kabul, U.S. military spokesman Lieutenant Mike Cody confirmed the Saturday attack but said there were no reports of casualties on either side. In a briefing today, the Foreign Office in Islamabad strongly reacted to the latest incident involving cross-border firing and damage to civilian life and property in Pakistan. But incidents of U.S. rockets landing in Pakistan are on the rise. Saturday's incident was the third in the last 6 weeks. For Free Speech Radio News, Masroor Hussein, Islamabad.
The conclusions of an 18-month United Nations inquiry reportedly call for the immediate closure of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center and the prosecution of those accused of torturing detainees. David Enders files this report.
The UN Human Rights Commission draft report says the U.S. should put the more than 500 detainees at Guantanamo on trial or release them. The U.S. government argues that it can hold enemy combatants, the new legal term which has been given to the prisoners, for as long as it likes, regardless of whether there is evidence to charge them, in order to prevent them from returning to the battlefield to carry out attacks against U.S. troops. It is much the same argument that has been made to justify lengthy detentions without charges in U.S. military prisons in Iraq, where thousands more are detained. The report, a copy of which has been obtained by London's Daily Telegraph, equates the force-feeding of hunger strikers and certain interrogation techniques carried out against detainees with torture. Bill Goodman is the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which has long advocated for release of Guantanamo detainees.
The operation of Guantanamo totally disregards international law and disregards international norms of humane behavior. And often what goes on is torture.
The full report is scheduled for release on Wednesday. In New York, I'm David Enders for FSRN.
India's Supreme Court today ruled that the French aircraft carrier Clemenceau must be examined by a commission of naval officers to see if it is safe to be dismantled in an Indian shipbreaker's yard. This after France's defense ministry admitted yesterday to misplacing 30 tons of the asbestos that is supposed to have been removed from the ship. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
The French Defense Ministry claims that 115 tons of asbestos were cleared out of the Clemenceau before it was sent off on its final controversial journey to the Indian state of Gujarat. But now the ministry says that only 85 tons arrived at the center where they were to be buried. Embarrassed officials say that maybe the paperwork was wrong, or maybe the missing material has been misappropriated. Environmental campaigners Greenpeace accused the French Navy of lying when it claims that all but 45 tons of asbestos were removed before the Clemenceau set off. They say that there are between 500 and 1,000 tons on the carrier and that it's a danger to the lives of the Indian workers who will dismantle it. India's Supreme Court today ordered a committee of retired naval officers to be set up to examine the aircraft carrier to see if it can enter Indian waters. It said that a previous panel of experts, which reported today, was too deeply divided and had failed to answer a number of questions. French President Jacques Chirac is due to visit Delhi next Sunday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
A fire set this weekend in a Baptist church is the latest arson in a string of recent blazes in rural Alabama, where a total of 10 Baptist churches have been burned in the past 2 weeks. Investigators say there is no racial pattern to the crimes, as churches with both black and white majority congregations have been targeted. Unlike the 9 previous fires, Saturday's blaze was set in broad daylight. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff announced plans today to reform the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, one day after a report released by House Republicans placed blame on Chertoff for many of the failures in Hurricane Katrina response. Meanwhile, members of a Senate committee heard testimony that FEMA mismanagement contributed to wide-scale abuse and fraud of government funds in Katrina's aftermath, and one senator called for FEMA to be dismantled. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has more on these developments from Capitol Hill.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff released plans to reform the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA.
We have to address major challenges not as independent stovepipe agencies and certainly not as lone rangers, but as a unified team.
Those plans include updating technology and software, implementing consistent contracting policies, and sending FEMA employees to shelters rather than the victims contacting FEMA. This comes one day after a draft report obtained by the Washington Post places blame on top officials, specifically Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, saying he implemented the government's response to Hurricane Katrina late, ineffectively, or not at all. The report also says the White House failed to engage the president on the seriousness of the disaster and that Michael Brown, former FEMA head, was inexperienced and not qualified to handle such a task. That report, released by a group of Republican congressional members, criticized local officials and the media for exacerbating reports of violence in New Orleans in the days after the levees broke, which the report said delayed relief efforts. House Democrats didn't participate in this investigation, predicting partisan leniency. This report is the most critical to date. Meanwhile, the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs heard testimony on fraud, abuse of funds, and government waste in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, all of which was blamed on FEMA's mismanagement. Republican Senator Susan Collins from Maine questioned DHS Inspector General Richard Skinner about the thousands of unused mobile or modulated homes.
My question for you is the basic one. How did this happen?
Essentially, it's because FEMA did not have a plan in place to react to the massive requirements that they had for housing. That, coupled with they were experimenting with or used for the very first time a housing area command that has never been, that concept has never been used for anything as great as this before. There was lack of communication. There was lack of coordination.
Many aren't being used because they are sitting in a prohibited floodplain in Hope, Arkansas. Only 1,000 of the 26,000 purchased are being used. They cost the government more than $900 million. Senators expressed concern at the widespread fraud cases reported, both small and large. FEMA handed out $2,000 debit cards, half of which were duplicate claims, costing the government $10 million in waste. And an estimated thousands of check reimbursements were obtained by people using false Social Security numbers. Gregory Cutts is Managing Director for Audits and Special Investigations at the Government Accountability Office, an independent oversight leg of the government. He placed the blame on FEMA.
It's really a management issue, Senator.
Senators were troubled by the amount of no-bid contracts issued to perform cleanup, rebuilding, and ongoing work in the Gulf Coast region. Democratic Senator Carl Levin from Michigan questioned Skinner, the DHS Inspector General.
How many of the contracts that were awarded by, say, DHS have been awarded on a no-bid basis, without competition?
405 of the 712. Right. But then again, if you look, there's also some with very limited competition. And so it's well over half. And I think that's the trend throughout the entire Katrina operations, just not within DHS.
Those are just the no-bid contracts worth more than $500,000. There are many more smaller contracts awarded, and 4 are worth more than $500 million. But frustrated Democratic Senator Mark Dayton from Minnesota had little to say at the Senate hearings except this.
I reached the point where I almost say, you know, we ought to just
dispense with FEMA. Just start all over again.
DHS Secretary Chertoff will testify before the Senate tomorrow on his views of Katrina response. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Thousands of Gulf Coast families displaced by last year's hurricanes will become homeless today as FEMA quits paying for hotel rooms for a second group of evacuees. A federal judge in New Orleans denied a temporary restraining order this morning to stop the evictions, although many of the promised FEMA trailers have not yet arrived. Christian Roseland has more from New Orleans.
8,000 to 10,000 families nationwide that are subject to this cutoff today, 213. And in this city and the metropolitan area, it's thousands, 4,000 to 5,000 families that may be affected.
These are the numbers of people that independent lawyer Tracy Washington says are being kicked out of their temporary lodging in hotel rooms in New Orleans and around the country today. Washington and Loyola Law Clinic's Bill Quigley attempted to acquire a temporary restraining order against FEMA to stop the evictions, but Federal District Court Judge Stanwood Duvall denied the request around noon today. Quigley says that the federal government is abandoning people who have lost their homes.
The people of New Orleans and the people of Gulf Coast, I think, have been forgotten again by the federal government, and this is another example of how the president and Congress have not done their job for the people who've been victimized by this disaster of unprecedented proportions in our country's history. It's a very disappointing day for our nation. The scenes that people are going to see of all these people being put out, not just in New Orleans, but in Birmingham, in Texas, and in New York, and California, all over the country.
It's unusually cold in New Orleans this week, so cold that the mayor's office has opened 4 free shelters for the homeless. And many of those who spent last night in fancy hotels in the city's business district, like the Astor Crown Plaza Hotel on Canal Street, will now find themselves staying wherever they can. Derek Johnson has been standing out in front of the Astor Crown Plaza talking on his cell phone to FEMA with a bag of clothing at his feet. Johnson, like many, says that he does not have anywhere to go.
I'm going to live in my car till I find somewhere to go. They said it was 2 forms of paper I was supposed to send. They have you filling out all these papers, and if the papers don't go through in time, then they telling you, you know, like, that is your fault, basically.
Melvin Jackson works at the Astor Crown Plaza and says that he can't understand why it is that so many who are being asked to leave cannot occupy public housing that is mostly vacant in the city.
A lot of people that could be staying in there right now, a lot of them, they're just shutting them down. They got 10 housing projects. You only got 2 of them up, the Melfamine and the Ivory Building. The rest of them, they didn't put gates all around because they don't want nobody back in. And they ain't nothing, most of them didn't even have no water damage. And they got all these trailers locked up. And places it really ain't doing nothing.
No one knows what will become of the families that filed out of the hotels this morning or how many of them will be on the streets of New Orleans tonight. As the city prepares for its annual Mardi Gras festivities and tourists from out of town begin to check into many of the hotel rooms which are now vacated. For FSRN, I'm Christian Roseland in New Orleans.
At least one person was killed and 4 injured in Haiti today when United Nations troops opened fire on demonstrations. Protesters have largely paralyzed the nation's capital of Port-au-Prince and managed entry into a hotel where election authorities have announced the results of last week's vote. Popular candidate René Préval was expected to win in the first round, but authorities now say there will likely be a runoff to decide the beleaguered nation's new leader. A coup d'etat toppled Haiti's democratically elected government nearly 2 years ago, and as the sad anniversary approaches, Haitians in the diaspora are reflecting on the role that Canada has played in destabilizing their country. Aaron Lakoff has more from Montreal.
On Tuesday, February 7th, Haitians turned out in overwhelming numbers to vote in the country's first elections since former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was forcibly removed from office on February 29, 2004. It has been a difficult 2 years for the country, with an interim government imposed, thousands of political prisoners jailed, and near-daily killings in the capital city of Port-au-Prince. The elections were delayed 4 times by the CEP, the Provisional Election Council, after they finally settled on February 7th. The CEP reasoned that the prevailing insecurity in the country wouldn't allow for a climate of democratic elections, but many of the country's poor are charging that the delays were a disruption tactic used by Haiti's elite to prevent the favored candidate, René Garcia Préval, from winning. Now, 6 days after the vote, there are still no official results. If a candidate does not receive 50% of the vote tally, then there will have to be a runoff vote on March 19th, a prospect that most Haitians are hoping to avoid. Serge Bouchereau, a Canadian of Haitian origin and member of the group Haitian Resistance of Quebec in Montreal.
On sait très bien, tout le monde le sait, que M. René Préval...
We know very well, everyone knows it, that Mr. Préval is victorious in the first round with about 70 to 75% of the vote. But what are they waiting for to give the results? According to the electoral decree, the election results must be provided on February 8th. Today is the 10th. These are very partial results that only give us a taste. Why does it take so long? And during this time, the Provisional Election Council gave a press conference to forbid any journalists from giving results.
On Sunday, thousands of Haitians held a demonstration in Port-au-Prince to demand that Préval be named president. Prior to the elections, Préval was polling in the lead with 32% support. As tensions mount on the island, Haitians living in Canada are denouncing the role that Canada has been playing in destabilizing their home country. Canada now has an official foreign policy doctrine called Responsibility to Protect, which is used as the reasoning to support the coup d'état in Haiti. Magali X, a Haitian solidarity activist and member of Voisin 7 in Montreal, explains Canada's interests in Haiti.
Canada came with this idea of the responsibility to protect. Within the responsibility to protect, one country can intervene directly in another country with the people directly. And actually, it is said in within the responsibility to protect that when the UN takes too much time to intervene, we can go and intervene. And when we intervene, well, we have also the responsibility to rebuild the solid economy, because there is a lot of profit in rebuilding a country.
Canada has put $54 million towards supporting Haiti's election process. Activist groups across the country are now starting to call into question Canada's role as a peacekeeper in Haiti. Anthony Fenton, a Vancouver-based activist and co-author of Canada in Haiti.
When the diplomatic maneuverings were taking place as toward who was going to take the lead and take the, you know, the front role in Haiti after the overthrow of the elected government in February of 2004, it came out in Canadian parliamentary hearings that part of the reason Canada was asked to play a leadership role by the United States, by Roger Noriega, one of the key architects of the coup d'etat, was that Canada enjoys a perception in the hemisphere as a counterweight to U.S. Encroachment in the affairs of sovereign countries in the Western Hemisphere.
The Canada-Haiti Action Network is demanding that Canadian forces now withdraw from Haiti and that Canada pay reparations for Haiti's losses. Meanwhile, Préval's lead has dropped to below 50% in the count, and CEP members are alleging that the counts are being manipulated. As Haitians wait for the results, the country is bracing for chaos. This is Aaron Lakoff reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Montreal, Canada.
The FBI raided half a dozen private homes and businesses in Puerto Rico on Friday as part of an investigation into what they say was a plot by the Boricua Popular Army, or Macheteros, to carry out terrorist acts on private interests and the general public in Puerto Rico. No one was arrested in any of the raids, leading activists to denounce the FBI actions as intimidation of the Puerto Rican pro-independence movement. We're joined on the line by Vicente Panama Alba, a Puerto Rican pro-independence activist in New York, where a demonstration is planned for tonight. Why are you helping to organize this event?
The demonstration tonight before 26 Federal Plaza here in the city of New York is an act of protest and to denounce the activities, the actions of the FBI in Puerto Rico last Friday. But it goes well beyond that. It is evident to many of us that there is an agenda in place from the Bush administration as it pertains to Puerto Rico. The actions of Friday were clearly not aimed at preventing any terrorist activity or pursuing any criminal activity. They were evidently a political act aimed at terrorizing or are attempting to terrorize the Puerto Rican population and particularly the pro-independence sector of that population.
What was the pretext under which the FBI conducted these raids?
The excuse that has been put forth by the FBI is that they in fact prevented a terrorist attack by the macheteros against Puerto Rican people. The macheteros have never, ever conducted any activities against Puerto Rican people. So this is clearly a politically motivated operation that took place. I mean, it has been preceded by the assassination of Filiberto Ojeda Rios back on September 23rd, where he was actually surrounded in a farmhouse, was sniped from an FBI helicopter, and then left to bleed to death over the next 24 hours. There is a concerted attack against the people of Puerto Rico and the right to self-determination being orchestrated in Washington, D.C. And we believe, or at least many of us, are very clear that this is part of the overall policies by the Bush administration against Puerto Rico and all of Latin America.
We've been speaking with Vicente Panama Alba. For more information, you can email him at panamaalba2@yahoo.com. That's PANAMAALBA, the number 2@yahoo.com. President of the National Indian Education Association, Ryan Wilson, delivered the annual State of Indian Education Address today. As Yame Shea reports from Washington, Wilson says declining funding and intrusive mandates imposed by the No Child Left Behind Act are impeding the advancement of Indian education.
A report by the National Indian Education Association points out that recent federal policies have started to reflect the actual needs of Indian education, and Native American students have benefited from these changes. However, Indian children still have the highest high school dropout rates and the lowest college graduation rates of all ethnic minority groups in the United States. President Bush has proposed to cut funding for several Indian education programs in his budget plan for fiscal year 2007. Wilson says such a setback did not surprise him, as federal funding for Indian education has shrunk systematically in the last 5 years. He says the Congress has told him repeatedly that education of Native American children has to give way to other priorities.
Every meeting you go into with every staff, every congressman, every senator, they're expressing that the natural disaster, the tax breaks, and the war has shrunk the budget. It's a reality. It's not a perception. It's shrunk the budget. And they still consider Indian education a discretionary program, not an entitlement program.
The National Indian Education Association reports that the No Child Left Behind Act is not applicable in Native education settings. According to testimony taken from hearings conducted in Indian country. The report also states the act promotes testing scores at the expenses of programs focused on native language and culture. Under the No Child Left Behind Act, schools that fail to meet state testing standards should be subject to government intervention. Wilson called the act the most intrusive federal legislation in recent history, as it erodes Native American sovereignty.
The tribes who have a unique and special relationship with America, our relationship is federal, not the state. And so they're dictating to us curriculum alignment to meet their standards in our own schools. And so for self-determination and for our values, it's not working.
Joe Garcia is the president of the National Congress of American Indians. He says Indian country, not the federal government, should provide solutions to Indian issues.
Let's not give it to the education people and say you find us the solution. We have to drive the solution, and the solution has to be on our mindset, on our hearts, and our way of life, and I think that's got to be the answer.
The Senate Indian Affairs Committee will have a hearing tomorrow on the state of Indian education. I'm Ye Meixie for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C.
More than 100 housekeepers have been protesting outside San Diego's downtown Hyatt Hotel daily for the past week and a half, calling for the corporation to rescind a recent change in policy. FSRN's Miles Ashdown reports on the new rule that Hyatt housekeepers are calling unsafe and inhumane.
The new policy requires Hyatt housekeepers to clean 30 rooms in each 8-hour shift, nearly doubling the previous requirement of 16 rooms. Their wages, as low as $8.50 an hour, were not increased. Hyatt told the workers it's a corporate, not a local policy, and they have no choice in the matter. The workers believe otherwise.
Hyatt, escucha!
Marching through the streets with about 160 others is Sofia Mendez, who has worked at the Hyatt for 2 years now. She says the housekeepers love working at the Hyatt, but it's impossible to clean 30 rooms in one day.
And it's hard, and mentally, you know, you want to be a good worker, and you want to finish your job, but what they're doing is unhuman. It's, you know, it's not possible.
Nearly all of the housekeepers at the San Diego Manchester Grand Hyatt have joined Hyatt Housekeepers United for Our Rights. Ever since the policy went into effect January 17th, the all-women, mostly Hispanic and Filipino housekeepers, have rallied together each evening on the street opposite the hotel. This tactic has worked in the past. In 2000, just next to the Hyatt, the Marriott wanted to increase the required rooms from just 14 to 17, a relatively small increase. More than 150 Marriott housekeepers protested for 30 days straight and won every demand.
The only power that we have is the power out here on the streets, and the unity and the determination of the women to fight for their rights.
Adriana Hasso is a member of the Organizing Committee for Labor Rights in the Raza Rights Coalition, which has helped the Hyatt housekeepers organize against one of the nation's most prestigious hotels. So far, negotiation with management has not gone well. When asked to show how to clean 30 rooms in a regular shift, management refused. They said 70 other Hyatts have this policy in place. But when asked for a list of these hotels, management refused again, saying, as a corporation, they reserve the right to protect this information. Hyatt says the workers can either clean 30 rooms each day or quit. Rosa Rodriguez has been cleaning rooms at the Hyatt for more than 13 years.
They want to make more money, and this is not fair for us. This is not for, you know, for healthy, for everything. This is not fair.
Rodriguez claims she just wants time to clean each room properly. Doubling their workload, Sofia Mendez says, is a threat to the physical and psychological integrity of the housekeepers.
You can only do so much. I mean, you're stressed out, your body aches, and then you still got to go home and do, you know, you have families, we have lives. Come on, you know, work with us, hear us.
While the workers are not calling for a boycott or a strike yet, they are reaching out to Hyatt housekeepers across the nation. If indeed this is a corporate change, the housekeepers say Hyatt could face nationwide resistance. Until then, the San Diego housekeepers will continue to march through the streets and demand justice. In San Diego, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miles Ashdown.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.
This is Independent Native News for Monday, the 13th of February, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A new lawsuit alleges sexual abuse of a minor by two Catholic priests in a Western Alaska village. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The suit alleges that priests Andrew Erda and Bernard McNeil raped and otherwise molested the plaintiff when he was a boy attending Catholic school in the Yukon River village of Holy Cross more than 30 years ago. Erda now lives in a retirement home in Hungary and is named as a co-defendant in the suit, along with the Fairbanks Catholic Diocese and the Society of Jesus. McNeil died in 1992. Plaintiff's attorney, Ken Rosa, who represents dozens of alleged abuse victims, says the allegations in the new case are the worst he's heard.
The brutality of his attacks on this little boy and others in the village
are just shocking. I mean, they are beyond words.
The suit says the abuse occurred between 1967 and 1971, when the victim was between 4 and 7 years old. It also alleges that church officials knew about the abuse, covered it up, and failed to protect the plaintiff and other victims. The plaintiff is seeking in excess of $100,000 in damages. The case is the latest that accused 10 Fairbanks Diocese priests and 2 church volunteers of sexual abuse over several decades. 98 abuse complaints have been filed against the diocese by 94 alleged victims. 5 other cases have been settled. Diocese Human Resources Director Ronnie Rosenberg says the church continues to offer counseling to victims and is awaiting court rulings on the statute of limitations and admissible evidence in key abuse cases.
Basically, where we're at right now is we continue to work on healing strategies, and as more things become known and as these cases firm up more and court rulings occur, then we're certainly committed to being as transparent as we possibly can be and updating the public accordingly.
The diocese is potentially facing having to pay millions of dollars in restitution to victims, but Rosenberg says it has not made a determination on whether declaring bankruptcy is its best option. Rosenberg would not disclose what financial reserves the Fairbanks Diocese has to potentially compensate victims. In Fairbanks, Alaska, I'm Dan Bross.
Connecticut's governor is proposing using money from the state's 2 tribal casinos to give tax relief to state residents. WSHU's Ebong Udama reports.
In her 07 budget, Connecticut Governor Jody Rell is proposing eliminating a regressive car tax for state residents. She wants to pay for it with state revenue from the Mashantucket Pequot's Foxwoods Resorts Casino and the Mohegan Sun Casino.
We will intercept the $435 million we collect each year in casino revenue, along with another $61 million in general fund revenue, to ensure municipalities will not lose any local revenue.
The revenue is the result of a compact between the state and the 2 Indian tribes. In the past, Connecticut governors have used the money to plug holes in the state budget. This is the first time the money is being used to offer direct tax relief to state residents. Foxwoods Resorts and the Mohegan Sun are 2 of the most profitable casinos in the world. But in recent years, state officials have fought hard to prevent any more Native American casinos in the state. In Fairfield, Connecticut, I'm Ebong Udama.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs says wildland fires in Oklahoma have claimed more than 8,000 acres of native land since November 1st. The fires have burned a total of 400,000 acres across the state. Now the BIA is offering a reward of up to $10,000 for information about the fires. Fire protection specialist Pat McDowell told the Oklahoman they feel a responsibility to pursue arsonists the best way they can. The BIA manages about 1 million acres of land in Oklahoma. McDowell says tips are often the only way to solve arson cases. The WeTip National Anonymous hotline is 1-800-472-7766. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
The 9th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national town hall discussion on poverty and homelessness in America.
It's a matter of life and death for the people who are homeless.
I'm not giving up, and I don't want nobody to feel sorry for me.
I've been homeless off and on for some time.
People who are middle class or upper middle class forget that they too can become homeless.
I think it would be pretty startling for the majority of the public to know that within about 2 blocks from the White House itself, there are homeless people sleeping in parks.
The 9th Annual Homelessness Marathon, coming live from the streets of Atlanta, Georgia.
What we got here is a problem of human beings being treated like refuse, and I think the only solution is some sort of moral awakening.
We're in danger as long as we continue to paint homeless people in this country as somehow other.
The Homelessness Marathon on this radio station.
Hear the Homelessness Marathon on KBOO this Wednesday, beginning at 4 p.m. until 6 a.m. Thursday morning.